Welcome to Learning English from the Voice of America. I'm Katie Weaver. Our 30-minute program is designed for people learning English. Today, Susan Shand tells about some British troops serving with NATO in Estonia. Then, Phil Dierking and I tell about a National Parks Arts Program. We also hear a short segment of What It Takes, a podcast from the American Academy of Achievement. Today's subject is retail business leader Leslie Wexner. And we close the show with an American story. But first, here is Susan Shand.
The drive from the Russian border to the Tapa military base in Estonia is only 3 hours by tank. And that concerns the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, or NATO. The military base once belonged to the Soviet Union. Now, it has 1,000 NATO soldiers, as well as millions of dollars worth of military equipment. The soldiers are officially part of NATO's Enhanced Forward Presence Program, which began in 2016. It was set up to stop any Russian intervention in the Baltic states, Estonia, Latvia, or Lithuania. The three countries joined the Atlantic Alliance in 2004. The NATO troops are considered a tripwire force. That means any military action by Russia into the Baltic states would lead to a NATO reaction. The alliance has promised to defend its members. 2 times in the past week, Russian aircraft violated Estonian airspace in the Gulf of Finland, said an official for the Estonian Defense Forces. Each time, he said, a Russian airplane entered the airspace for less than 1 minute and failed to answer radio calls from Estonia's air navigation services. The Estonian Foreign Ministry requested talks with the Russian ambassador and gave him a diplomatic note each time, the Baltic Times reported. VOA joined troops from Britain's 1st Battalion Yorkshire Regiment as they began a 6-month deployment at the Tapa military base in early July. We're here defensively, but we're here to fight and defend should the need arise, said Lieutenant Colonel Jim Kennedy. Russia's 2014 takeover of the Crimean Peninsula and invasion of eastern Ukraine worried the Baltic states, especially Estonia. Just 10 years ago, Russian forces invaded Georgia, which is not a full member of the alliance. The Russian government continues to support 2 breakaway provinces there. The Estonian government has spent a lot of money to enable the NATO deployment and welcomed the troops. In Tallinn, Estonia's capital, all eyes are on the July 16th Helsinki meeting between Russian President Vladimir Putin and U.S. President Donald Trump. NATO's strategy when dealing with Russia, it's showing strength and being prepared to enact our collective defense, but it is dialogue at the same time. We await the outcome of Helsinki, said Kennedy. President Trump said the Helsinki summit could reset relations with Russia. But the NATO message from Estonia is clear. We are prepared for Russian aggression.
Artist Rosalie Hyslett starts every day by opening a map of the Great Smoky Mountains National Park. Over breakfast, she plans her walk for the day. She packs food and a sketchbook and then leaves for her walk in the woods. Hyslett spends all day exploring the park and sketching what she sees. At the end of the day, she returns to her cabin and starts painting pictures based on the sketches. Hyslett has been doing this since the beginning of June as part of the United States National Park Service's Artist in Residence Program, or AIR.
Artists have been important to American national parks for a long time. In the 1870s, an art movement called the Hudson River School documented natural America from the northeastern coast to the Wild West. During that same time, the work of American painter Thomas Moran helped persuade the U.S. Congress to create the country's first national park, Yellowstone, in the western state of Wyoming. Since 1969, the National Park Service has provided artists the chance to be officially involved with American parks through AIR. Chris Amidon supervises the Resident Artist Program at Isle Royale National Park in Michigan.
It's just about connecting to the next generation of art and the public with the landscapes of the national parks.
Resident artists spend 2 to 4 weeks in a park. Artists of all kinds may take part, including painters, writers, photographers, and musicians. The artists spend their time working on art inspired by their surroundings. They also agree to donate at least one artwork to the park. Currently, NPS runs 47 artists in residence programs in 30 different states. Amidon said one NPS goal is to bring new people from a mix of age groups and ethnicities to the parks. The AIR program is important for building a bridge between the parks and the public, he said.
Hyslett said it was her childhood growing up in an artistic family in the Appalachian Mountains of West Virginia that led to her career as an artist. The painter says she is most inspired by small forms of life in nature, such as fungi, insects, and animals.
I've always really enjoyed the stories of things that are underrepresented.
Hyslett says she is combining her paintings and drawings created in the Smokies to make a jigsaw puzzle. It will show the many species of fungi and insects in the park. One of Hyslett's favorite experiences at the park so far was the light show produced during the synchronous firefly season. The insects fill the woods. As night falls, they begin to light on and off as part of the reproduction process. Within moments, they are all flashing at the same time. Hyslett created an artistic workbook for children that explains how the bugs do this and why. Hyslett believes that the residency program helps show the national parks in a new way that can appeal to different people.
so many artists are inspired by nature, but sometimes people that aren't artists don't see their sources of inspiration as clearly. It makes art more real to people, and that I think adds value to the national parks.
The Great Smoky Mountains National Park is the most visited park in the U.S. It receives over 11.3 million visitors every year. Its artist-in-residence program is one of the largest. Sheridan Roberts is the park's coordinator of volunteers. Parks and the arts are both things that we need, she says, but it can be hard to find the financial support they require. So, Sheridan adds, we should both hold hands when we can. As a National Park Service artist in residence, Hyslett also teaches at local art schools, as well as for Job Corps, a government program offering job skills training to young adults. This relationship with the local art community is another important part of the AIR program. They partner for art projects and choosing AIR candidates.
Not all of the AIR art is visual. David Huckfeldt is a musician and member of the band The Pines. While his band was taking a break last September, he entered the Resident Artist Program on Isle Royale National Park. The group of islands found in Lake Superior is the least visited national park in the States. Huckfeldt seemed to enjoy that quality.
It contains pretty much all of the most necessary aspects for an artist these days. I mean, solitude, natural beauty, very low expense, and the ability to immerse yourself in the history and geography of our national parks.
Huckfeldt wrote 16 songs inspired by his experience at Isle Royale. He recorded them for a new album when he returned home to Minnesota. It is his first solo music project. While at the National Park, he also performed concerts for visitors and took video recordings in the park. He plans to use those recordings to create a music video for one of the new songs. He will donate the video to the park.
Huckfeldt says it is important for people to experience the parks. After all, he said, we own these parks. They're taxpayer-funded. Sheridan Roberts of the Great Smoky Mountains National Park agrees. The national park system would not have existed today had it not been for creative visionaries, she said. Writers, photographers, painters, it was artists and volunteers who began the movement that introduced the national park system in this country.
There is nothing particularly sexy or salacious in the story of Les Wexner's rise to become the titan of women's lingerie. He's a family guy with four kids. He's active in a synagogue in Columbus, Ohio. He is a multi-billionaire with the art collection, the houses, and the yachts to prove it. But at heart, he's a 5'6" guy from Columbus, Ohio, in the schmata business.
Came from very modest circumstance. My father was born in Russia. My mother was the first child in her family born in the United States. No one had gone to college, and everybody worked hard and pretty much struggled. I felt terribly constrained just by the family circumstance and wanted to be successful, whatever that meant. It's successful might have been when I was in high school, maybe one day I'd have a car. You know, when I got out of college, maybe one day I'd have a new car. Pretty modest goals.
But they were goals that would take him beyond the life his parents had provided.
I didn't think my parents really knew what they were doing. you know, I knew they loved me and I loved my parents, but they weren't providing direction. And I knew if I was an adult, I could probably do better.
But as Les Wexner explained to Mary Jordan, the Washington Post reporter who interviewed him for the Academy of Achievement in early 2017, he never imagined that his better life would involve a career in retail.
My mom and dad had a neighborhood store. I'd gone to law school. I really hated law school. In fact, I hated school generally. And my dad said, why don't you just hang around the store for a few months before you, you know, begin your life? And so I said, okay, what do you want? And he said, well, if you hang around for a few months, you'll learn how to open the store and close the store. It was a little neighborhood store. It was like 15 feet wide. But that was the source of their income. And I said, okay. And he said, because after Christmas, he said, your mom and I'd like to go on a vacation. And he said, you know, we've never had one. He said, I've never asked you for anything, but I would trust you to open and close the store, take the money to the bank, you know, just do simple things. I said, okay. And they did take the week off in January. Columbus had a blizzard, and their vacation was driving from Columbus to Miami, spending 3 days in Miami and then driving back. So that was their big vacation after a lifetime. And kind of happenstance, had a blizzard in Columbus. I went to the store, and it was like, I don't know, 18 inches of snow, so there was no traffic. And I felt very obligated to be there because I was kind of guarding the fort, and there was just nothing to do. No, there should be no one's going to come to the store. And I got bored, so I was curious to see what categories of merchandise my dad and mom made money in. And I could sort out the invoices, and they'd kept track of sales by category of merchandise, shirts and pants and skirts. And I would look through the invoices to see. And I figured out that in what my dad called sportswear, they were making substantial profits. And in the big ticket items, then dresses and coats, they were making no money. And when he came back from their vacation, he sat down at a Woolworth's coffee shop, and I gave him the big ta-da. And he said, it's impossible. He says, we make money on the big ticket items. They said, no, you see them as big tickets, but you're taking big markdowns, and there's no profitability. And from that, we got into a very classic father-son argument. So you know, he'd say, you know, go get a job. You know, your mom and I have struggled our lives to have this small business, and we're going to run it the way we want to run it. And you don't know what you're talking about. And I said, Dad, here's the numbers. They don't lie.
You can find the whole podcast on our website, learningenglish.voanews.com. Now it's time for an American story. Here is Mammon and the Archer by O. Henry.
Old Anthony Rockwall, who made millions of dollars by making and selling Rockwall soap, stood at the window of his large Fifth Avenue house. He was looking out at his neighbor, G. Van Schulite Suffolk Jones. His neighbor is a proud member of a proud old New York family. He came out of his door and got into a cab. He looked once, quickly as usual, at Anthony Rockwall's house. The look showed that Suffolk Jones was a very important man, while a rich soapmaker was nothing.
"I'll have this house painted red, white, and blue next summer," said the Soap King to himself. "And we'll see how he likes that."
And then Anthony Rockwall turned around and shouted,
"Mike!"
in a loud voice. He never used a bell to call a servant.
"Tell my son," he said when the servant came, "to come to me before he leaves the house."
When young Rockwall entered the room, the old man put down the newspaper he had been reading.
"Richard," said Anthony Rockwall, "what do you pay for the soap that you use?"
Richard had finished college 6 months before, and he had come home to live. He had not yet learned to understand his father. He was always being surprised. He said,
$6 for 12 pieces.
"And your clothes?"
"About $60, usually."
"You are a gentleman," said his father. "I have heard of young men who pay $24 for 12 pieces of soap, and more than $100 for clothes. You have as much money to throw away as anyone else has. But what you do is reasonable. I myself use Rockwall soap because it is the best. When you pay more than 10 cents for a piece of soap, you're paying for a sweet, strong smell and a name. But 50 cents is good for a young man like you. You are a gentleman. People say that if a man is not a gentleman, his son can't be a gentleman. But perhaps his son's son will be a gentleman. But they're wrong. Money does it faster than that. Money has made you a gentleman. It has almost made me a gentleman. I've become very much like the two gentlemen who own the houses on each side of us. My manners are now almost as bad as theirs. But they still can't sleep at night because a soap maker lives in this house. There are some things that money can't do, said the young man rather sadly. Don't say that, said old Anthony. Money is successful every time. I don't know anything you can't buy with it. Tell me something that money can't buy. And I want you to tell me something more. Something is wrong with you. I've seen it for 2 weeks. Tell me. Let me help you. In 24 hours, I could have $11 million here in my hands. Are you sick?
Some people call it a sickness.
Oh, said Anthony. What's her name? Why don't you ask her to marry you? She would be glad to do it. You have money, you're good-looking, and you are a good boy. Your hands are clean. You have no Rockwall soap on them.
I haven't had a chance to ask her, said Richard.
Make a chance, said Anthony. Take her for a walk in the park, or walk home with her from church.
You don't know the life of a rich girl, Father. Every hour and minute of her time is planned. I must have her, or the world is worth nothing to me. And I can't write to say I love her. I can't do that.
Do you tell me, said the old man, that with all my money you can't get an hour or two of a girl's time?
I've waited too long. She's going to Europe the day after tomorrow. She's going to be there 2 years. I'm allowed to see her alone tomorrow evening for a few minutes. She's coming to the city on a train. I'm going to meet her with a cab. Then we'll drive fast to the theater where she must meet her mother and some other people. Do you think she would listen to me then?
No. Or in the theater?
No.
Or after the theater?
No. No, Father, this is one trouble that your money can't help. We can't buy 1 minute of time with money. If we could, rich people would live longer. There is no hope of talking with Miss Lantry before she sails.
Richard, my boy, said old Anthony, I'm glad you're not really sick. You say money won't buy time? Perhaps it won't buy all of time, but I've seen it buy some little pieces.
That evening, his sister, Ellen, came to Anthony to talk about the troubles that lovers have.
He told me all about it, said Brother Anthony. I told him he could have all the money he wanted. Then he began to say that money was no use to him. He said money couldn't help him.
Oh, Anthony, said Ellen, I wish you wouldn't think so much of money. Money is no help for love. Love is all-powerful. If he had only spoken to her earlier, she could never say no to our Richard. But now I fear it is too late. All your gold cannot buy happiness for your son.
At 8 the next evening, Ellen took an old gold ring and gave it to Richard.
Wear it tonight, she said. Your mother gave it to me. She asked me to give it to you when you had found the girl you loved.
Young Rockwall took the ring and tried to put it on his little finger. It was too small. He put it inside his coat in a place where he thought it would be safe. And then he called for his cab. At the station, he met Miss Lantry.
We must not keep my mother and the others waiting, said she.
To Wallach's Theatre, as fast as you can drive, said Richard to the cabby.
They rolled along 42nd Street to Broadway, and from there to 34th Street. Then young Richard quickly ordered the cabby to stop.
"I've dropped the ring," he said, getting out. "It was my mother's, and I don't want to lose it. This will only take a minute. I saw where it fell."
In less than a minute, he was again in the cab with the ring. But within that minute, a wagon had stopped in front of the cab. The cabbie tried to pass it on the left, but a cab was there. He tried to pass on the right, but another cab was there. He could not go back. He was caught where he was and could not move in any direction. These sudden stops of movement will happen in the city. Instead of moving along the street in their usual orderly way, all the wagons and cabs will suddenly be mixed together and stopped.
"Why don't you drive further?"
said Miss Lantry.
"We'll be late."
Richard stood up in the cab and looked around. He saw a stream of cabs and wagons and everything else on wheels rolling toward the corner where Broadway, 6th Avenue, and 34th Street meet. They came from all directions, and more were rolling toward them. More and more were caught there. Drivers and cabbies shouted. Everyone on wheels in New York City seemed to be hurrying to this place. "I'm very sorry," said Richard. He sat down again. "We can't move. They won't get this straight for an hour. If I hadn't dropped the ring, we..."
"Let me see the ring," said Miss Lantry. "Since we really can't hurry, I don't care. I didn't want to go to the theater. I don't like the theater."
At 11 that night, someone stopped at the door of Anthony's room.
"Come in," shouted Anthony.
He had been reading and put down his book. It was Ellen.
"They are going to be married, Anthony," she said. "She has promised to marry our Richard. On their way to the theater, their cab was stopped in the street. It was 2 hours before they could move again." "Oh, Brother Anthony, don't ever talk about the power of money again. It was a little ring, a true love ring, that was the cause of our Richard finding his happiness. He dropped it on the street and had to get out and find it. And before they could continue, the cab was caught among the others. He told her of his love there in the cab. Money is nothing, Anthony. True love is everything."
"I'm glad the boy got what he wanted," said old Anthony. "I told him I didn't care how much money..."
"But, Brother Anthony, what could your money do?"
"Sister," said Anthony Rockwell, "I'm reading a book with a good story in it. It's a wild adventure story, but I like it. And I want to find what happens next. I wish you would let me go on reading."
The story should end there. I wish it would. I'm sure you, too, wish it would end there. But we must go on to the truth. The next day, a person with red hands and a blue necktie, whose name was Kelly, came to Anthony Rockwell's house to see Anthony.
"That was good soap we made," said Anthony. "I gave you $5,000 yesterday."
"I paid out $300 more of my own money," said Kelly. "It cost more than I expected. I got the cabs, most of them, for $5, but anything with two horses was $10. I had to pay most to the cops. $50 I paid to two, and the others $20 and $25. But didn't it work beautifully, Mr. Rockwell? They were all on time, and it was 2 hours before anyone could move."
$1,300. "There you are, Kelly," said Anthony, giving him the money. $1,000 for you, and the $300 of your own money that you had to spend. You like money, do you, Kelly?"
"I do," said Kelly.
Anthony stopped Kelly when he was at the door.
"Did you see," asked he, "anywhere on the street yesterday, a little fat boy with no clothes on, carrying arrows?"
Kelly looked surprised.
"No, I didn't. But if he was like that with no clothes, perhaps the cops caught him."
"I thought Cupid wouldn't be there," Anthony said, laughing. "Goodbye, Kelly."
And that is all the time we have today. For VOA Learning English, I'm Katie Weaver.